Good morning, friends. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. And I'm really happy to have in the studio with me today Mr. Dr. Jerry Ostermiller, former director of the Columbia River Maritime Museum, and now kind of a man about the country, I suppose. Jerry, welcome.
Well, thanks, Jim. And I don't know about the doctor part of it, but I'm glad to be here, and it's good to be among old friends.
There you go. Tell me a little bit about your history, Jerry. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school and all of that?
Holy cow. Well, you know, I've got to frame that, and I heard my wife's words in the back of my head saying, short version. But
We've got a half an hour.
Okay. Well, I was born in Oregon. I'm an Oregonian native. I'll be at the other side of the state. I was born in Ontario. I grew up in Idaho. Went to grade school in Sandpoint, which is a really beautiful part of the state.
The home of Mark Furman.
Well, that's right. And then I moved to Boise with my parents, of course, and went to high school there, went to Boise High. And, you know, when I was in Boise in high school, it was a much, much smaller town, and we knew everybody. All of us knew all the kids and all the schools. And my mother still lives there. I travel over there about every couple of months to keep an eye on her, and I'm just amazed at what a metropolis it is now.
Well, Boise is kind of generated a name as being a jazz town. A lot of jazz players there.
Yeah, there are, and there's been a big historic preservation movement in that community, and you know, adaptive reuse of old buildings, and got a lot of style and class in the old part of town and North End, and it's great to see that people are bringing that good music back and keeping it alive.
So then what happened?
Well, jeepers, I hippied around for a while. I worked really hard at being a good hippie. I hitchhiked from Seattle to Mexico and hung around in San Francisco. I lived on Waller Street even. And after a while, I decided that I wanted to figure out what the meaning of life was, so I needed to go back to school. I actually went to a community college here in Portland and got an associate degree in electronics and did that for a while. I took machine tool operation and welding, found it real satisfying. But electronics kind of suited me more. I've been a radio ham since been in junior high. And one thing led to another, and I ended up going back to Boise to visit my parents and got myself enrolled at Boise State University, got an honors degree in history and social science, and then went to graduate school and became an archaeologist, social anthropologist, worked for BLM for a while, stomping around doing cultural resource management, and then the governor hired me to be Idaho's very first historic sites administrator. I worked for the State Historic Preservation Office, and that was a pretty neat job, Jim. I got to travel all around the state, all the property that the governor was responsible for, writing the management plans, working with 501c3 organizations, mom-and-pop heritage people. Ended up getting involved in the Historic Preservation Council for Idaho and was its president even at one time. And would go to the legislature and lobby for money and, you know, put roofs on buildings and that sort of thing. Did that for about 5 years and then got a postgraduate fellowship in historical administration at Williamsburg, Virginia, through William and Mary, and ended up in Astoria, which is probably the best thing that ever happened.
And then you came to Astoria. Why?
I came here for only one reason, and that is the fabulous, wonderful Columbia River Maritime Museum. And they'd been going through a lot of changes, a little bit stressed out, and I think they went through three executive directors in 3 years, and for some reason, they heard about me and said, well, maybe this guy could do it. And, you know, about all I knew about maritime stuff is that I was familiar with prairie schooners.
Yeah, there you go.
And certainly in southern Idaho, I knew about dry docks. But I was real lucky. You know, this community is great. I met people who started educating me properly. And, you know, went out in a river with gill netters, got to know the Coast Guard, got to know the bar pilots, got to know local fishermen. I ended up buying a small sailboat and teaching myself how to do that and sail around for about 8 years. And, you know, the secret to success as Jim, the success you've had all your life with your construction companies is the quality of your crew. And the Maritime Museum is blessed with really terrific people, great board of directors, and so it made it pretty easy for me.
Why did you leave that job if it was so cool?
Well, you know, most people don't know this, but the average tenure for a director of a museum almost anywhere in the United States is around 5 years. And there's good reasons for that. You got to keep ideas fresh and moving, and everybody needs to be stimulated. When you're working in a 501c3 environment, everything's got to click really, really smoothly. I did 5 years, and then I did another 5 years, and then I did another 5 years, and all of a sudden I woke up one morning and I realized I was 60 years old, and I had 20 years in. And, you know, if I owned the museum, if it was my own business, I'd probably still be doing it. But, you know, it's good to get fresh blood, fresh ideas. And my wife and I both were at a time in our life where we realized that it's now or never for exploring, you know, other dimensions of our life.
Have you been happy with the way that the museum has been taken care of since you left?
Well, you know, I am. It's a quality institution, and it will outlive all of us. And it's got a strong positive trajectory. You know, one of the things people do is they come up to me and say, well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And, you know, the institution is doing this now. What do you think about it? And it's important to understand that there's a jillion ways to skin a cat. Everybody's got their own style and their own vision. What you really want to have happen when you get new leadership in place is have a fresh, new way of looking at things. I think I was pretty lucky in that I could kind of reinvent the museum every couple of years. We were at a point where we were growing very, very rapidly. But it's nice to see new people on the board. It's nice to see good leadership. It's nice to see it continuing to growing with ambition. And the other part of that, Jim, is when you have a change of command, it's really important that the old guy gets off the deck. And so I've gone out of my way the last 5 years not to haunt the museum and go down and mess around and be talking to everybody about stuff because, it really has its own rhythms now.
Maybe you could speak, before we get off the museum, maybe you could speak a little bit about how the museum came about. I recall the name of Ralph Klepp. There was just a riverbank there. And then the vision came, and now there's a museum. How did that happen?
Well, over the entire continent of North America, there was a movement in the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s for creating these institutions. And they all centered around a larger-than-life personality. Carl Cordham is a guy like Ralph Klepp, who started San Francisco Maritime Museum, for instance. And South Street Seaport was started by a personality, and Mystique Seaport, Mariners Museum in Virginia. You can just go down the list, and they all seem to have kind of a charismatic, larger-than-life personality. And Rolf was a local who was an extremely talented man. He was an artist. In World War II, he received an honorary Lieutenant Commander's Commission. And to do scientific illustrating and work on war films and media type stuff. And after the war, and he was very successful, by the way, and after the war, he worked for Time Magazine, Look Magazine, those big New York firms. Remember those when we were kids? Before he had color TV, we had color magazines.
Right.
And he was a great illustrator and pioneered a lot of different concepts. And then following that career, he worked for NASA. He was the lead illustrator publicist department for of the Mercury program. And a lot of his artwork is famous. You know, you don't see it, you don't think about it, but it's astounding. And he made a tidy sum. He was able to come back and retire, and he did the city logo. He did work for the Park Service. He did a lot of giving back to the community. And he ended up on the board of the Clatsop County Historical Society, and he said, "We need a gallery or two about maritime history," because that was his love. And being a larger-than-life guy, his ideas outgrew the capacity of the Historical Society, and so he formed his own board, and the museum was born. Really an astounding story. The most interesting thing about Rolf is that his vision was very, very clear. He had a tendency to look beyond the immediate. For instance, he named the museum the Columbia River Museum, not the Astoria Maritime Museum, not the Oregon Maritime Museum, but the Museum of the Great River of the West. And he saw that as a bigger story, a bigger potential, and a more ambitious project. And being an artist, he drew and drew and drew and worked with local architects to come up with the shape of the building, and everything was symbolic. It was so symbolic that it was sited at the foot of 17th Street, and he worked out a deal with the city for the address to be 1792 Marine Drive. And 1792 was when the river received its name from the ship Columbia Red Abiba. So he was that kind of a person. I'm just sorry I never met him. I certainly studied everything I could about him, and I really admire the man. And he had some strong core values. Museum would always maintain debt-free. It would never become dependent on the largesse of society by the government, and be independent of city, county, state, or federal monies. And you know, it made it a real pleasure to work. It made it a little harder for me sometimes. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, a great source of pride. And we have a reputation for being a shining example of how to do it right. So it's been good.
Well, during your term there, Jerry, what were some of the big events that came about?
A number of things. We got the lightship listed on the National Register, which was certainly deserving. We went through at least one or two remodelings of the dock. I think the last remodeling that just recently happened is probably a much better facility than what we did out of wood. But we were able to put the dock to use. We were the first group, I think, to demonstrate that we could have a cruise ship tie up at the foot of 17th Street. That was quite an adventure. I actually went down to where the ship was docked and talked to captain into coming over and tying up. When everyone said it couldn't be done. And from that point on, it's been a permanent feature. We remodeled the museum completely. I think we reprogrammed it. We certainly restaffed it. Strengthen the board, build up the endowment, and I think in every way, I feel that all of our time over that 20-year run was really well spent, and turned out to be good for all concerned.
Yeah, it's a wonderful facility, and we're happy to have it here. But since then, you've got a lot of different irons in the fire. I know that you mentioned briefly some of them. Could we talk about what you're doing nowadays?
Sure. Right after I retired, I got drafted by the Commandant of the Coast Guard to do some foundation laying in New England for a National Coast Guard Museum. Every military branch has more than one large museum, and the Columbia River Maritime Museum's Coast Guard exhibit is second to none in the nation. So it certainly caught the attention of the Coast Guard leadership in Washington, D.C., and that was an exciting project. I lived in Connecticut, and did a lot of traveling. I'd, you know, be in New Orleans, I'd be down in Florida, I'd be in Seattle, I'd be, you know, different places with the Coast Guard Foundation. But as exciting as it was, the timing couldn't be worse. It was 2009, and all the promised financing just sort of dried up, I think. But it just got to the point where we decided that we were going to shelve it. And it was a kind of a heartbreaker, because I think it would have been a fabulous program. But nevertheless, we did get the concepts down. We got the values down. We figured out how we were going to do it and what the mission was going to be about. And it's kind of nice. It's being revised right now. I keep getting emails from my colleagues back there, and it's starting to take on a life again. And so I'm real excited about that. I probably won't have much to do with it. It's just too hard for me to travel back and forth. That's one of the things I learned.
Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with Jerry Ostermiller, former director of the Columbia River Maritime Museum. And so let's continue with some of the stuff you've got going now, Jerry.
Okay, well, when I got back here, I started doing a little bit of a spot work for the city. Paul Benoit needed someone that had some of my skill set, and he really couldn't afford to put another person on full time. So he had a few little administrative projects, and I did that. And it was a good deal for both of us. I didn't need any benefits. I didn't need any you know, sick leave or anything like that. I just a straight hourly wage and a modest one.
Mm-hmm.
But allowed me to get involved with people I knew and get some things happening with a few projects.
What were some of those projects?
Well, the initial one was working with the police and fire department to reinstall a radio repeater system up on top of Skyline where the old water tower was. That was all relocated near the Astoria Column. As you remember, in 2007, with the big storm, there was a failure in that system, which put a hardship on everybody. And redundancy is always a good plan when it comes to emergency communications. Since I understood how all that stuff worked electrically and physically and how the systems had to operate, it was easy for me to communicate with the service providers. And also, being a lifelong volunteer with emergency services, I had a pretty good relationship with fire, EMS, and police departments, understood their needs. And then I also had a pretty good feeling for how to work with the neighbors and get them to buy into the idea of relocating that equipment next door to them. So it was a fun project, and we got it done, and it went pretty smoothly, and I feel really good. Every time I drive by there, I look at those antennas that we even camouflaged and painted green so they would blend in with a forest.
Now, that's up by the water tank up on Skyline?
Yeah, it is. And we did our best to hide all the equipment behind the tower,
mm-hmm.
and that worked really, really well. It was interesting. It took longer just because of the bald eagles. We had to work our installation plan around their life cycle. And it was kind of fun. You know, at the time, it was pretty exotic having bald eagles. Now they're all over the place.
Yeah, we've got a pair up behind our house.
Yeah, so it's, you know, projects like that. Paul gave me a title. He called me Special Projects Administrator. And I did another project like that for the county, doing the environmental impact statements. Since I'm a federally licensed professional historian, I'm registered with the Secretary of Interior, I can do environmental impact statements for cultural resource clearances. So when the National Guard needed to put up their new emergency operating center at Camp Rylea, the county hired me to do their EISs for the tower that was installed there, and that was fun as well. The other things I'm doing is more on the volunteer end of it. I really enjoy volunteering, and I got to tell you, our audience out there, that if they ever find themselves worrying through what's the meaning of their life and wondering why they're not doing something that's kind of exotic and fun and really, really special, the answer is volunteering. And volunteering allows you to get involved in things that you probably wouldn't otherwise be involved in. And it also allows you to give something back to your community. And it's a joy. So I'm a founding member of the Oregon Mentor Corps, which is a new product that's developed by the state of Oregon for cultural support. And we put together about 30 practitioners, most of which are currently employed at institutions. We have curators. We have a few of us administrator types. And so it kind of works like this, Jim. If there's a mom-pa horse and buggy museum in southeastern Oregon, maybe, and you're struggling along and they haven't had a lot of experience, but they've got, you know, a wonderful vision and a lot of enthusiasm, and they may get a letter, say, from the Attorney General's office wanting to know about their Form 990. they can call Oregon Parks and Rec and get in touch with us, and we could put together a team. And we can go down there, spend a couple days with them, and walk them through all those steps and help them figure out how to do that, teach them how to do visioning retreats. We have a huge amount of expertise for curatorial needs. Currently, we put together some quick response team for disaster preparedness for museums. And we actually got that granted up nationally, and that program has become real successful. So that's a way way we can give back. I also had the opportunity to work for the Coast Guard here in Astoria. They needed a community liaison officer who knew the local resources and also understood them. All the time I've spent with the Coast Guard through exhibits and working, you know, with the Coast Guard in Washington, D.C., I have a pretty good understanding of how they think and how they work. And I've also really admired that organization. I think it's one of the most shining examples of a government agency that is completely and totally value-driven. Kind of reminds me of the Rotary Club. You know, it's like service above self. And how can you not admire these men and women whose one goal in life is to have that moment when they can run out of a burning building with a little basket of kittens? And I just admire the heck out of them.
So I agree with you.
So I was asked to be their sector coordinator for their auxiliary, which is half of their workforce. And I did that for 2.5 years, and it was astonishing being treated as a commander in rank in my relationship, and being a member of their senior management team and going over there every week. I had to get a national security clearance and all that stuff. And I learned so much about them, and I was able to help a few times. But more than that, I got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see what it's like to be a senior officer in the Coast Guard, and something I'll treasure forever. But again, that's kind of a unique and exotic volunteer opportunity, but was certainly fulfilling.
We've had several Coast Guard people on this show over the last few months, and they've been remarkable guests. Really enjoyed talking with them. Started out with Captain Jones. I know you're going to the change of command ceremony this morning, aren't you?
I am, and I'm digging out my Coast Guard auxiliary uniform. I'm going to wear my SDBs. I'm going to salute, and I'm proud of Captain Jones. And I'll tell you something else. Coast Guard people do not have to be in the Coast Guard. They are selected to be in the Coast Guard. And they're well-educated. They have good manners. They're straight-up people. They're like I say, it's a value-driven organization with lots of virtue. And it's wonderful being around them. And their officers, when they retire, it's amazing how many of them decide to stay in Astoria because they appreciate the community. One of the things I'm really excited about is Captain Jones, when he finishes today and retires, one of his retirement targets is that he's been selected to serve on the Board of Trustees of the Columbia River Maritime Museum.
Right.
So there you go. And it's also the 75th anniversary of the Coast Guard Auxiliary. So it's a nice fit.
Yeah, we've had the leader of the ANT team come in and talk to us about aids to navigation. And I agree with your assessment of the Coast Guard. They're a wonderful part of the community, and we're fortunate to have them here. And in fact, we are a Coast Guard city, whatever that means.
Well, it means a lot. In fact, that was one of the projects. I wrote the nomination.
Yeah, tell me a little about that.
Well, there's only a handful of cities in the United States that meet the criteria. And what it's really about is a commitment to be supportive of the Coast Guard mission and to do things like have a heads-up attitude about racial minorities, women in service, create an environment in a community that's good for children to grow up in and have good schools, to embrace the Coast Guard by inviting them in to participate in the service clubs and all of that. So it's about the community, and it's handshaking with the Coast Guard, and I think something we all ought to be proud of.
Yeah, we've been trying to, speaking of volunteers, of course, this station is run pretty much by volunteers, and so is the Astoria Riverfront Trolley. And we've been kind of hoping to get some Coast Guard participation in the trolley. So far, I haven't seen it, but maybe when you're out there today, you can remind them about the Astoria Riverfront Trolley.
Well, Jim, I'll do my best to start lobbying on that one. I'll be the special projects administrator for getting Coasties aboard that wonderful trolley.
So we just got a few minutes left, so what other irons you got in the fire?
Well, I just recently appointed to a four-year billet as a state commissioner. I'm on the State Heritage Commission. I was on a commission about 10 years ago, and then when I got involved with the remodeling, I stepped down, and Jan Mitchell took my seat, and she did a fabulous job. In fact, she just recently retired from the commission as its chairperson. So there's some symmetry there. They called me up and said, "Hey, Jer, can you come back?" So I'm excited about that. I'm also doing shipboard lecturing with cruise ships, which is kind of fun. But the most exciting thing, Jim, I'm working for NOAA as their itinerant special projects maritime historian. And they sent me up to Michigan last year on these little missions. And I've got some real exciting things coming up in the next 24 months with Dr. Robert Ballard and Dr. James P. Delgado. We're going to be on some oceanographic vessels surveying the South Pacific, towing underwater drones, looking for archaeology. And I'm real excited about that.
Yeah, they've been using them trying to find that Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, but they haven't found it yet.
Yeah, they will.
You think
so? If it's there, they'll find it. You know, you like to say you got to find a haystack before you can look for the needle.
Yeah. So these new missions that you're doing, kind of earlier, you kind of implied that you're kind of tired of doing a lot of traveling, but it sounds to me like you're going to be doing a bunch of traveling.
Well, you know, my dad always said when you go to town to get the leather to make new harness for the team, you just got to understand that the tail goes with the hide. When you buy that big piece of leather, you got to get it all. They won't sell you just a good piece of it. So it's just the cost of doing it. You know, it's sort of like doing a decompression stop when you're a diver. You know, that's the price you pay for diving deep. Mm-hmm. Just it goes with the territory. But the mission's going to be fabulous. I think we're looking at the first 4 months is just doing Pearl Harbor this spring, and it's going to be neat working with those guys. It's going to end up, I think, with a National Geographic special, so it'll be fun.
Oh, we've got 1 minute left, but I wanted to it seems to me that you were, and maybe still are, a member of the High Angle Rescue Team or whatever you call that, the guys that go out and pull people off of cliffs.
Well, for years, I was one of the original members, you know,
right.
And I even became an instructor for a while. And also as a member of the Sheriff's Office Underwater Dive Team and that thing, because I'm a, you know, underwater archaeologist kind of guy. But, you know, I'm at 65, it's getting harder for me to keep up with those kids. So I think sitting in a Connex box on the back of a oceanographic research ship flying a drone is probably going to be more my style now.
Well, Jerry Ostermotz, it's been really rewarding to have you visit with us here, and I appreciate you coming in.